Welcome to this special spin-off audio program based on a satellite meeting held in December during the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this unique event, we paired community-based oncologists with each of our five faculty members, Drs. Kim Blackwell, Harold Burstein, Cliff Huddis, George Sledge, and Chris Twelves, and prior to the meeting, I conducted a planning Skype call with each faculty person and the community physicians who presented cases and questions for discussion during the meeting. In the two follow-up faculty interviews on this program, we review some of the cases presented and many of the questions received from the audience using their iPads. To begin, I met with Dr. Huddis, and we reflected on a case that oncologist Dr. Richard Zelkowitz presented to him, a 59-year-old woman with a prior history of ER-positive HER2-negative infiltrating lobular cancer, for which she received adjuvant chemo, but only short-lived tamoxifen treatment, which she tolerated poorly. Recently, she was found to have ovarian and intraperitoneal recurrence of the same tumor. Dr. Huddis reflected back on his reaction to this first-line metastatic case and his thoughts about a management strategy.
She has metastatic breast cancer, and she needs the same conventional palliative approach as every other patient with metastases. In this case, your therapeutic choices are, to some degree, focused by the fact that it's A, lobular, which is B, typically hormone receptor positive, as this case was, and not necessarily so responsive to chemotherapy. So now we're down to the question that was raised at our evening meeting, and that is, what's the appropriate first-line palliative therapy for a patient getting hormone therapy? And the last couple of years have challenged some baseline assumptions about hormone therapy, notably the dogma that sequential single-agent therapy was necessarily best. And we've had mixed results from two studies that have looked at the combination of a SERD in the form of fulvestrant with an aromatase inhibitor versus a single-agent aromatase inhibitor. And in particular, the randomized SWOG study published last year in the New England Journal was associated with a survival advantage for the combination. So that's fairly motivating, since so few of our therapeutic choices have impact on overall survival when we first test them in the first randomized phase 3. And it's especially interesting because this was in the first line setting. Now, the subtlety is that that particular trial had a large number of completely therapeutically naive patients. They weren't merely people with relapse. They were people who had never received prior hormone therapy, even for their breast cancer. They had de novo stage 4 breast cancer. And if I remember this case correctly, that's not exactly the situation here. She had a prior history of cancer. But I would generally err in that direction for this patient.
What are the situations where you specifically think about an AI and fulvestrant?
Well, I think about it often, actually, because, again, we're dealing with a lot of palliative therapeutic options for these patients, and it's rare that we're able to talk about a measurable and presumably real difference in overall survival. And even though we treat people with metastatic breast cancer for a palliative benefit, and we measure that in quality of life, and we measure that in progression-free survival, we really do want to change overall survival if we can. So I think for each individual patient who might be a candidate for this combination, and for me that's anybody who's aromatase inhibitor naive with limited prior therapy, I talk about the combination. Now, the downside is fairly technical. At the outset, it involves loading with fulvestrant, and of course, it involves a parenteral injection on an ongoing basis. And these patients can have a long median progression-free interval, so we are committing them to a slightly more painful monthly therapy if we do it this way versus giving just the oral agent, the AI alone. But I think for survival advantage, the bar is pretty low to err in the direction of the combination.
Have there been any discussions in the cooperative group about looking at this strategy in the adjuvant setting?
Yes.
What is, do you think something's going to happen?
It's a little hard to say right now because there have been other proposals looking at novel targeted agents for the same patient population. And as you know, we're very, very, I would say, selective right now in terms of what trials we can activate through the federally funded cooperative group system.
So another issue that comes up with metastatic ER-positive HER2-negative disease, of course, is mTOR inhibition and specifically everolimus. Anything that came out at San Antonio has come out in the last few months to shed more light on this question. And where do you stand right now in terms of your own practice, in terms of the strategy?
I think that the issues that we just reviewed with regard to fulvestrant and esrazole are, as an introduction, the same issues when one's talking about exemestane and everolimus. The Bolero 2 trial, which has been presented and published now, shows a really striking improvement in progression-free interval for people who get the combination. It has yet to report a statistically significant overall survival advantage, however, and that's a mitigating factor. The second issue is that the toxicity price, to be very fair about this, in indirect comparisons, is certainly greater than what one would see with fulvestrant and an aromatase inhibitor. When we give the everolimus, the mTOR inhibitor, we are at least required to be aware of some significant more chemotherapy-like toxicities. For example, stomatitis, change in taste, and a relatively rare but nonetheless reported incidence of pneumonitis, and that's even potentially very severe. And then there are other more minor and somewhat frequent issues to consider. So your question at root is, when do we do that instead of just giving exemestane alone? And I typically offer everolimus to patients who would have fit the Bolero 2, plain and simple. So people who have progressed on first-line hormone therapy and are candidates for exemestane, I actually generally try to put them on exemestane and everolimus if I'm not enrolling them on a study. And to be fair, the clinical trials in that space are related to this with other inhibitors of the PI3 kinase pathway.
I noticed the JCO just published the temsirolimus trial, which was negative. Any thoughts about that, why it was negative, and other strategies out there? Lisa Carey was part of an editorial that got into this question of how do we do better with ER-positive disease?
Well, there are a few things, I think, to say. It is true that the tamoxifen-based trial was not so positive, and that's by Wolf et al. In the JCO. So I think at the moment we're struggling. One of the frustrations in all of this has been that there was an assumption that abnormalities in the PI3 kinase pathway, which are common but not universal in ER-positive disease, would be the selective factor for the efficacy of drugs that target components of the pathway, and thus far that has not been reported. So I think we're seeing mixed results because we're looking at temsirolimus versus everolimus. We're looking at tamoxifen and versus AI. We're looking at more versus less pretreated patients. And I think that there's still a fair bit of noise in this.
Any comments about the San Antonio paper? Because it got a lot of attention on the CDK inhibitor, a cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitor, PD-0332991. That was with letrozole.
Exactly. Very exciting. This is the first of these CDK inhibitors to seem to have a breakout in breast cancer. There have been a number of drugs in this class that have been under development and studied for years. And as Rich Finns reported in a randomized phase 2, there appeared to be a really striking improvement in progression-free and overall survival. Now, all that means today for our community is that we should be very enthusiastic about getting a phase 3 done. Neil, you and I and all of us have collectively gone down this road before of the striking randomized phase 2 result that has...
Everybody always brings up Inipirib.
Well, that's only one example. There are others. And I want this to work. But what we need to do, to be fair, is get the phase 3 done.
Just out of curiosity, you're so good at explaining pathways and you're good with graphics too. But what is a cyclin-dependent kinase and how does it relate to hormones?
Fundamentally, these are components of the cell cycle system, and whether they're uniquely related to hormones and hormone-sensitive cancer or not, I think has not been established. These drugs have been developed or tested in sarcoma, in triple-negative breast cancer, in lots of places, and these CDKs are thought to be important in cell cycling throughout the malignancy spectrum. So I think we're going to have to see how this story unfolds. Maybe this drug is going to also be effective, for example, in chemotherapy. There are trials of this drug with paclitaxel and other conventional chemotherapy drugs. There are trials of this agent as a single agent. So, I mean, this is the breakout result, but by no means should we assume yet that this is the place where these drugs will only be effective.
So another case that Rich brought up to you was a young lady, I think she was about 40 at the time of the meeting, who'd received multiple hormonal, almost everything you can imagine, including everolimus, XMS, stain for metastatic disease, and yet was in very good condition. And he was kind of thinking of what other options might be out there. And in our discussion, we sort of kind of got into this issue of some of the work your group is doing, looking at androgen receptors and anti-androgens. And, you know, actually, it turns out, I don't know what's going to happen with this lady, but you actually thought she might even be eligible for a study you're doing right now. Can you talk about that work?
Well, there's a long history of interest in the androgen receptor. I always remind everybody that we've been possibly targeting the androgen receptor with testosterone from the beginning of the modern era. Halotestin was given as a treatment for metastatic breast cancer. Ashley Doan, working as a pre-medical student with William Gerald at our place, looked at a series of patients who had ERPR-negative breast cancer and found that a subset of them had a gene expression profile that looked like hormone-sensitive breast cancer, but they did not have ER or PR per se. And they didn't have mRNA for ERPR, and they didn't stain by IHC for ERPR. And looking at what's called a principal component analysis, they deduced that this subtype was closely or most likely to be similar to AR signaling. And they went back and did IHC and found androgen receptor in these cells. Now, they were about 10% of the ERPR negative breast cancers. There were a small number of HER2s, and some of the HER2s are also AR positive. If you look, and we did this subsequently, at triple negative breast cancer, it runs about 10% that are AR positive using a DACO IHC kit. Others have done this as well. The group in Vanderbilt, for example, has defined a luminal subset that's AR positive. And the parallel observation was that a substantial proportion of ER-positive breast cancer, anywhere from 60 to 80%, actually have AR, although it's not been knowingly and directly targeted. So trying to find a non-toxic hormone-like therapy for people who have triple-negative breast cancer, we went with what's on the shelf, bicalutamide, and Tiffany Traina and Aicha Guchap at ASCO last summer presented the first results of a translational breast cancer research consortium study that we had initiated, where we gave the conventional dose of bicalutamide as used in prostate cancer to women with AR-positive triple-negative breast cancer, and we showed a clinical benefit rate in the range of 20% or so, which was sufficient to say that this could be a useful approach. Now, taking a page from our colleagues in prostate cancer, we are trying to move the ever more effective androgen receptor targeting agents into the clinic for breast cancer. And there are, in fact, have been clinical trials with abiraterone and ER-positive breast cancer. And now there is a trial of enzalutamide, MDV-3100, which was recently approved based on a survival advantage in prostate cancer. One of the interesting social points is these drugs are typically developed in men, and you have to go back and do phase one in women. So right now we're doing a phase one of enzalutamide, and it takes all comers because it's phase one, and a lot of the ER positives will have the androgen receptor anyway. So this brings me to the patient you asked about. She clearly seemed to have potentially hormone-sensitive breast cancer, and it's likely that she would have the androgen receptor. So for phase one, I don't think it'd be crazy to offer her the trial of enzalutamide, and that's what I had suggested.
As I was listening to you in terms of this issue of looking at, you know, now the endocrinology in women as opposed to men, it sort of leads into a case that was submitted by one of the people who attended the meeting. Let me just read it off to you. 51-year-old man with stage 3 breast cancer gets AC followed by weekly paclitaxel, radiation therapy, and then tamoxifen. Progressive disease 1 year later in bone only. Question is, which AI is better, steroidal versus non-steroidal? And I'd add in there, what about everolimus in a patient like this?
I would agree with you, but backing up a half step, remember the everolimus patient population was second line for metastatic disease, the Bolero 2.
Second line? Well, I thought they were just people with metastatic disease who progressed on an AI. It could have been
right. But it was a mixture, and this guy hasn't yet.
Right, he's only had tamoxifen.
Right. So what I would do with a gentleman like this, frankly, is I'd be blind to his XY versus XS status, and I would give him a non-steroidal aromatase inhibitor and follow that up potentially with exemestane and everolimus. You know, the other question, of course, which relates to where we began, is whether he would be a candidate for fulvestrant and an aromatase inhibitor.
Anything in terms of the endocrinology of men and the use of AIs you want to comment on? Do AIs have essentially the same benefit?
It's very hard to answer that question. There have been some case series that suggest activity that seems to be not unlike what is seen in women. There is, of course, no randomized data. There have been some oft-repeated suggestions that men sometimes abuse aromatase inhibitors because they block the conversion of testosterone, and therefore it's a way of secretly increasing their testosterone levels and bulking up their muscles. However, I believe that Paul Goss has actually looked at that in a small series and has failed to demonstrate circulating testosterone levels at least to change at all. So I think there's a lot of sort of hand-waving right now about it. Unfortunately, I think that the simple bottom line is that this gentleman who's 51 has to be treated like a postmenopausal woman, and I think we can outsmart ourselves if we try to do anything else.
So a few more questions from the audience. Question mark, everolimus and exemestane after exemestane failure. So I guess keep the exemestane going and add in everolimus. What do you think about that?
I don't know what to say about it because that clearly is not what was tested and it's not what I would normally be doing.
Everolimus with other endocrine therapies other than exemestane or an AI.
So again, while I think it's especially unlikely that the interaction with other AIs would be different, without data, I don't think that's what we should be doing.
Everolimus without exemestane.
Again, outside of a clinical trial, this is not something I would be advocating, though.
I want to move on to another area we talked about in the symposium, and Dr. Margaret Deutsch from North Carolina presented some adjuvant cases of ER-positive, HER2-negative disease, and one of the issues that she was asking about, and actually Hal Burstein discussed this, was the current role of Oncotype. But another thing that we got into that was particularly relevant with what happened at San Antonio was duration of adjuvant endocrine therapy, and particularly the ATLAS trial that was presented and then published in The Lancet. Do you want to comment on what they looked at and what you thought about it?
Yeah, I think it's a very important observation. So I'm happy to talk about that. Just a little bit of background. Everybody probably has in their mind the notion of 5 years of tamoxifen as a fixed standard. And some of us remember when that first came out, that was part of those four papers that changed how we treat node-negative breast cancer in the New England Journal in 1989. Three of them were chemotherapy studies, but one, the NSABP, B14, was a comparison of 5 years of tamoxifen versus not.
It was the famous NCI alert. Before we had consensus conference, before we had guidelines, so that's the way we did stuff.
It's before we had the internet.
Right.
It was right before. I mean, it's really, I actually mention this all the time when I talk to lay audiences and others. It's really quite sobering to think about the fact that Vince DeVita sent out a letter and
right.
We had to talk about all this, and we didn't have the benefit like we would now of getting a draft manuscript call in a PDF and calling it preliminary and whatever. I mean, it was really quite different. Anyway. The B14, of course, is also famous to many, I'm sure, of your listeners because that's the study that formed the foundation of the initial development of Oncotype, which you mentioned before, the recurrence score. So anyway, that study established that 5 years of therapy was effective, and there have been some other studies looking at shorter durations. In that study and in the worldwide overview, it looked like 5 years of therapy was better than shorter durations. Now, they re-randomized, and my recollection is around 1,000 patients who had finished 5 years of tamoxifen to stay on it for a second 5 years or not. And that cohort didn't do better, had some more uterine cancer and DVTs, and the trend without statistical significance was that 10 years looked like it was inferior to 5, but it was not statistically significant. A bunch of science was being developed around then, including the fact that under the continuous treatment pressure, many ER-positive clones of breast cancer in the lab, the MCF7 types of breast cancers, can develop an apparent resistance. Not only that, but when you stop the tamoxifen, they actually respond by dying. They start to see it as an agonist. And many of us had seen in the clinic over the years a few people with chronic ER-positive breast cancer who, upon progression, would develop a real response from simply stopping tamoxifen, the so-called tamoxifen withdrawal response. So all of that together made us all think that while we couldn't know for an individual patient what the right duration was, that 5 years was probably appropriate. And as you just mentioned, at that time, there was actually a formal warning issued that tamoxifen shouldn't be given for more than 5 years because of this possibility of inferior outcome. So Peto, who you know, was somewhat concerned, I think, and he said so out loud, that this was an overcall. And so they launched the Atlas and Atom trials. And in these trials, they looked at a longer duration. And the one that we're talking about today, Atlas, specifically looked at, it was up to 15,000 patients altogether enrolled. But what they reported was a subset, the 6,800 who had ER-positive breast cancer and were randomized to take 5 more years of tamoxifen or not. And the results, which have been widely reported, I think are really important. This is a much larger experience. It was prospectively planned, and there was an overall survival advantage for the longer duration. Not only that, but the separation in the curves continued to develop even after the 10th year, out to year 14. And this suggests more of that carryover effect that's been described in previous studies. Finally, while there was a further increase in the risk of uterine cancer for these patients, it was not associated with a mortality risk. And so taken all together, what this means, and I think it's important, is that for young patients who would only have tamoxifen as an option, it seems to me that if they have any meaningful risk, they probably should stay on the drug, especially if they're tolerating it by the 5th year. I think the other place where this has a real implication, of course, is in low and middle income countries, where for the moment, tamoxifen may still be the cheapest of the medical options for treating breast cancer. And this may be a relatively inexpensive way to drive the benefit further with hormone therapy. Now, the obvious question that you may be about to ask is, well, what about a postmenopausal woman or a perimenopausal woman? And here, I don't think this changes what probably has been our practice pattern for the last bunch of years, where we already knew that adding 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor following 5 years of tamoxifen was useful, MA-17, for example. And so I would think that for a patient who's peri or postmenopausal when you start therapy, that at the 5th year mark, swapping to an aromatase inhibitor would remain a reasonable thing to do. It may be a little safer. We don't have a direct comparison of 10 years of the tamoxifen against 10 years of sequential 5+5 therapy. But again, from a patient point of view, what all these studies now have in common is a consistent observation that longer therapy is better than shorter.
And of course, the real common question is, what about continuing an AI beyond 5 years? Do you know when the studies, I know there's a big NSABP study, I think there's some others, do you have any idea when we might see that? And what do you think, are you more likely to do that today because of what you saw with tamoxifen?
Well, if the principle rather than the specific is that 10 years of therapy is better than 5, I think this does raise real questions for patients who start on an aromatase inhibitor at age 56. And whether at 61 they should stop therapy because that's what's been reported, or whether based on the tamoxifen observation, one imagines that longer might be better. And I think one can't be dogmatic about this. Now, I have a tendency with the higher risk patients to make them aware of the controversy and make a joint decision with them about which way they would like to be wrong.
Another thing that we talked about, as I mentioned, with Dr. Deutsch, she had presented a couple cases to Hal relating to the issue of oncotype. And of course, the very first one she presented was a 60-year-old lady, 2.1 centimeter, ER-positive, HER2-negative tumor with one of 14 positive nodes. Can you kind of go back over, you know, the way you see it and the way you think you're seeing other investigators see this issue of the node-positive patient?
Yeah, this question, I mean, I actually answered email about this kind of a case today, for sure.
What was the case?
It was very similar. It was an invasive lobular cancer. It was 2 centimeters and a 70-year-old with diabetes and hypertension, but functional. And she had 2 positive lymph nodes, and somebody had sent the recurrence score off, and it was 9. And so the question from the clinician was, gee, he said, I was tempted to not give chemo until I got the results of the lymph node status, and now I think I should. So that's a nice introduction in a way to the same set of issues. So let's back up.
Can I just guess that you said don't give her chemo?
You can guess that. So if you remember, in B14, when the Oncotype was first developed, it provided a nice prognostic tool. It stratified tamoxifen-treated, ER-positive, mostly postmenopausal women who had node negative disease into higher risk or lower risk or intermediate risk. And it engendered a shrug of the shoulders because for several thousand dollars to fine tune somebody's prognosis ultimately to me doesn't seem very useful. In B20, using a subset of the patients who had been randomized where they all got tamoxifen, but they were randomized for a CMF or MF, but call it CMF for the moment, as you know, when the score was above 31, there was a clear separation in the curve favoring chemo, and when it was below 18, it was not so clear. 18 to 30 was, or 19 to 30 was intermediate. And then we launched a prospective study related to this, the TAILOR-X or ECOG or PACT study that Joe Sproner chaired. And in this trial, we redefined intermediate down to 11 to 25, but those patients in the intermediate range were randomized to get chemo or not, really to see whether it's safe to omit chemo for patients in that group. All of this is to say the following. The real utility of the test is to provide, in my opinion, a prediction of the marginal utility of adding chemotherapy to hormone therapy. We have seen consistent results in the other version of this experiment, the SWOG study that Kathy Albain published in The Lancet, 8814, which was tamoxifen or tamoxifen and CAF. Same result. High risk recurrence score, measurable chemo benefit, low risk score, no benefit, and intermediate was less clear. Now, the critical point, which is the area of tension for our community, is the following. In the 8814 trial, they were node positive patients. In the B20, they were node negative patients. So what we're starting to see here is that one can have high risk disease that is chemo insensitive. And that's how the Oncotype is helpful. So this is less of a foreign concept if one really thinks carefully about it than it seems. If I show you a patient with 12 involved lymph nodes and a 4-centimeter tumor, you would be classically tempted to give chemotherapy. But if it's triple negative, you wouldn't give trastuzumab just because it's high risk, and you wouldn't give hormone therapy just because it's high risk. You would say the target for those targeted therapies is not present. It doesn't matter how high risk the disease is, how poor the prognosis, these drugs are not effective. So in part and imperfectly, I see the Oncotype is doing for chemo what those markers do for those targeted therapies. A low Oncotype score just tells us that the tumor is less likely to be responsive to chemotherapy, and that's how I use it. So take a patient with 12 positive lymph nodes and a 4-centimeter invasive lobular cancer, 100% ER, 100% PR, 0 HER2, and an Oncotype of 5. It's entirely possible to describe that patient as having very high-risk disease and, unfortunately, not having chemosensitive disease. Now, that question is being addressed, not quite that case, but for lower node-positive patients in the prospective RX-Bonder trial that Anne-Marie Gonzalez is chairing for SWOG and the cooperative groups. In that trial, patients with 1, 2, or 3 nodes with scores up to 25 are randomized to hormone therapy alone or hormone therapy and chemotherapy. So that brings me to the case I presented to you. Yes, with an Oncotype of 9 and especially some comorbidities in the 8th decade of life, I use that score of 9 to justify not subjecting her to chemotherapy. And the case that you presented, you didn't give me the Oncotype score, but at age 60, with a 2.1-centimeter tumor and 1 positive lymph node, we would be offering the RX-Bonder trial. And if for whatever reason we had an Oncotype score and the patient was uninterested in the trial, I would be pretty comfortable omitting chemo for patients in the lowest risk cohort.
Yeah, this lady actually had a recurrence score of 12.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that makes it, you know, it's kind of an inside baseball thing because you're going by the 18 cutoff of the conventional test or you're going to go by the 11 cutoff of the node negative prospective trial, and you get into judgments about the relative risks, benefits of chemo and the marginal utility. But to say it another way, at 12, one is not hypothesizing a big effect. And again, she'd be smack in the middle of the randomization zone for patients on the RX-Bonder trial.
And I know, you know, the faculty pretty much agreed across the board with your overall strategy. And one of the questions we got into, you know, as you mentioned, the RX-Bonder trial limits up to 3 nodes, but outside a protocol setting, is there kind of an arbitrary number of nodes where you just sort of back off? What's your answer?
I don't have an answer because it really depends upon age. Let me be clear. A 39-year-old with ER-positive disease and a positive node, I'm not looking for an oncotype. I don't want to compromise for that young patient right now, personally. I think this is a place where our faculty might have widely divergent views. But at age 80, as you just heard, I might not have an upper limit node status anyway.
Anything else that came out in San Antonio in this realm of prediction benefit to chemo? You keep seeing papers that are coming out from the UK, and I guess it was really out of the AI trials looking at IHC to see whether or not that could sort of replace a test, an RT-PCR test like Oncotype. Any thoughts about that?
I think there's a technical problem at the moment, which is that the Oncotype, like it or not, has been partially validated using stored blocks from randomized trials. And what you see happening in many quarters is attempts to demonstrate that in a cohort of cases, another test using, for example, IHC for several markers performs with some percentage accuracy the same as the Oncotype. But they're not doing it in the context of randomized trials, and they're not doing it in a way that would allow you to make the same independent predictive comments. They're really correlating with the Oncotype. And I have my concerns about the kind of sequential surrogacy steps here. Look, I don't want to sound like an apologist or promoter for the Oncotype. Quite the opposite. I'm very careful in my use of it. But it is the one for which there is data from randomized trials. And for me, I do want to see data from randomized trials for anything that might be proposed in lieu of it.
So the last topic I want to ask you about, there were some cases presented by Dr. Andrea Stiebel from Newport Beach, California, adjuvant and neoadjuvant treatment of HER2-positive disease. And of course, the first case she popped up was a 53-year-old lady with a 0.8 centimeter ER-positive HER2-positive node-negative tumor. It's been 8 years now since the data was first presented. I remember, a month afterwards we were debating this, and it seemed we're still kind of there. We have learned some things. I mean, the last thing I saw that was kind of interesting was stuff that was coming out of your place. I think it was about a year ago. I think it was like a historical series looking at these tumors.
So look, here's, of course, the whole story is that these patients were largely not represented in the randomized trials. There are a few on the BCRG below a centimeter, but not a lot. There are very few events, and so one is not able to accurately rely on any meaningfully sized cohort of such patients from the randomized trials for guidance. The question is, A, do they have enough risk to justify extrapolating? And B, what regimen would you use? And there are a number of studies, MD Anderson, French, a few others, that have suggested that even below a centimeter in size, these patients have a very high risk of recurrence, up to 15% at 5 to 10 years in some series, despite having small node-negative tumors. What Heather MacArthur did at our group, and it's a second, to be honest and self-critical, it's a second-tier kind of evidence, but it's all we have, is that she used 2005 as a breakpoint. And with matched follow-up, she took a cohort of patients who did not get systemic therapy for sub-centimeter and above sub-centimeter node-negative HER2-positive breast cancer before 2005 and after 2005. And she demonstrated, if I remember correctly, about a 9% recurrence rate for the patients who had no systemic therapy and about a 1% rate for those who did with, again, matched duration of follow-up. So while it's not randomized and it's confounded by the fact that the systemic therapy grew from nothing to chemo and trastuzumab, it suggests that treating these patients could be appropriate. And that's what was published. And there have been other series similar to that, again, a French series among others. So I actually do seriously consider treating these patients. Obviously, she should benefit from hormone therapy being ER positive. But these are patients who we were enrolling on the Dana-Farber-led single-arm trial of weekly paclitaxel trastuzumab. And while that study's still being monitored by its DSMB, I suspect that that kind of therapy for them may be reasonable in terms of a risk-to-benefit trade-off, and I actually do consider that for such patients.
In terms of the choice of treatment, a lot of people utilize a trastuzumab paclitaxel regimen piloted out of Dana-Farber, but I don't know if it's activated or not, but I know that they're going to be looking at T-DM1. I'm just kind of curious, theoretically, how you think T-DM1 is going to play out in the adjuvant setting, particularly for these low-risk patients.
Well, remembering that even with HER2-positive disease, the majority of patients on a trial like this will not have an event. And knowing, as we saw last year at ECHO, that T-DM1 compares favorably, for example, to docetaxel trastuzumab, I think that there's reason to think that this could be A, equally or more effective, and B, less toxic. So we'll see.
Seems like we're kind of in a lull right now, I think, in terms of adjuvant data with HER2-positive disease. But we did see data at San Antonio from HERA looking at 2 versus 1 year, and from the FAIR trial looking at 6 versus 12 months. There was also the follow-up, the original NSABP and NCCTG trial survival analysis. Any of those things you want to comment on, or do you think have any clinical relevance right now?
Well, I think from a practical point of view, they're very clinically relevant, but they don't require much attention because maybe thankfully none of them really offer evidence against the conventional use of 1 year of trastuzumab. That said, you made a comment that there's a little bit of a dearth of data. That's perhaps true, but Affinity, which tests pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting, has accrued very well. And obviously, depending upon the rates of events, that's a study that should provide us with potentially practice-changing data in the next couple of years.
The other case that Dr. Stiebel presented was a patient who had a PR to, it was actually TCH neoadjuvant therapy, a pathologic CR, I should say, and she was questioning in terms of post-surgical treatment, radiation therapy, et cetera. Anything new that's come out in terms of neoadjuvant therapy of HER2-positive disease you want to comment on?
Well, there's not really anything new, I don't think, since the last time we've spoken. Obviously, everybody remains excited by the combination anti-HER2 therapy data presented last winter, 2011, at San Antonio, looking at pertuzumab in combination with trastuzumab docetaxel, looking at lapatinib in combination with trastuzumab and paclitaxel in the Neo-Alto. And there'll be potentially more data in this regard as the CLGB 40601 from Lisa Carey maybe matures in the coming months and years. So that's all well and good. The problem, and this is a big issue in the community for all of us, is that has not up until now provided a pathway formally for drug approval or labeling. And it remains unclear whether the magnitude differences we see with PCR for these regimens necessarily means anything measurable or detectable in terms of disease-free or overall survival, which in the end is the reason that we give systemic therapy for early-stage disease.